Good afternoon, everyone. I think we have more at the camp out than what we do here today. So it's very nice that they have beautiful weather to enjoy their time in Granbury. You know, brethren, there's no word in any language that arrests attention and quickens interest more than the word lost. More than the word lost. A lost child can cause a community, a state, or a nation. They go into a frantic hunt to track down that child. I think all of us are aware of what is known as the Amber Alert. That was created because of a young child who was kidnapped and eventually murdered. And driving on the highways, you often see a billboard advertising, you know, lost child. And now, I guess they call it a senior citizens alert, where they're trying to track down the senior citizens who may have Alzheimer's or dementia, and they've lost them. And so they have the entire state of Texas looking for that particular automobile. You know, our Lord Jesus Christ knew this. He talked about the lost sheep in Luke chapter 15. We're all familiar with that, right? Where a shepherd loses his sheep, loses a sheep, leaves the 99, and he goes out looking for the one. And when he finds it, he's elated and invites everyone, you know, to come and rejoice with him. In that same chapter of Luke chapter 15, in verse 8, it talks about a woman losing a very valuable coin. A little history on that is, at that particular time, often the ladies would receive 10 silver coins connected together with some type of, I won't say rope, but usually other type of connecting. And it would be something that they would have, they could put on their head. It was very special to them. It was often given at a time of their wedding, and it was something that could never, ever be taken away from them. And at that particular time, ladies didn't have a whole lot of possessions, you know. But that was something very special to that particular person. So if that coin ended up, you know, the 10 coins happened to break somehow and one is lost, it wasn't just the value, but the sentimental value of the coin that she's looking for. And so it says she looks everywhere. And of course, the final example is the lost boy. We know him as the prodigal son, right? And we all know the story, how the father would often be out front looking almost every day for that son to return. So Jesus Christ is aware of the word lost. And we know that he gives the example of the lost sheep, the lost coin, the lost boy, in order to let people know his attitude towards the lost. As a matter of fact, if you read Luke chapter 19, verse 10, still in the introduction, you'll see in Luke 19, verse 10, that he came to seek and to save the lost. That was his primary purpose. He had other responsibilities and purposes that he fulfilled, the replacing of Satan, etc. But it says that he came to seek and to save the lost. Now, one of the most tragic accounts in the Bible is that of the lost generation. A lost generation. An entire generation that failed to enter the promised land that God was offering to them. An entire generation lost. Now, we're all familiar with the story there in Exodus. Numbers has a lot of information on it as well. That after their long bondage in Egypt, God delivered Israel, set them off to freedom. He brought them through the Red Sea, led them to Mount Sinai, gave them the law, fed them manna. As a matter of fact, if you go through the entire account of their trip on the way to the promised land, you will find that he graciously attended to their needs and led them tenderly to the promised land, in spite of the fact that 10 different times they tried his patience. But what's amazing is each time they did, Moses would pray for them, and God says that he would forgive. And so he graciously led them along their way to the promised land. As a matter of fact, to reassure them of the promised land of rest. God told Moses to send out 12 spies to inspect the land and give the report. You find that in Numbers 13. If you'll turn over there, we'll go back and forth in Numbers 13 and Numbers 14 for the remainder of the sermon today. But you'll find in Numbers chapter 13, beginning in verse 1, it says, I, the Lord, said to Moses, send some men to explore the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the Israelites. From each ancestral tribe, send one of its leaders. So 12 men were chosen to go out and inspect this land that God was giving to them. Moses sent them out. And you'll find they were to do a number of things according to Moses' instruction. Numbers 13, verses 17 through 20 will give you that. I won't read that section, but you can while I'm talking. Numbers 13, 17 through 20. They were to, number one, see the inhabitants. Okay, check out who lives there. Were they strong or were they weak? Number two, they were to check out the cities, if they were walled or if they were tents. And number three, it says they were to examine the soil as to its fertility and productivity. And we know that they did just that. Matter of fact, we remember the story that when they came back with this cluster of grapes attached to a rod between two men, right? Two guys had it on their shoulders. It was so big and so heavy. A very beautiful land that God was providing for them. They completed their assignment, but we'll find as we continue, they went too far in presenting conclusions. And these conclusions are the conclusions that they reached, and also in offering recommendations for action that they came up with. Let me mention, not in my notes here, this was not within their jurisdiction. God wanted them to go see the land, the productivity, what was there. It was not within their jurisdiction to make suggestions that they did. We'll see that in a moment. These matters belonged really to God. He was the one who called them out of Egypt, led them on their way to the promised land, and was giving them that land. We know that according to Numbers chapter 13, if you'll turn to verse 27, Numbers 13, verse 27, we'll see that we have two reports being given from these spies. You had the majority report summarized in Numbers 13, 27 through 33. And let's read that. And as you consider their report, keep in mind that God had promised them the promised land. Numbers 13, beginning in verse 27. So they come back and they give Moses this account. We went into the land which you sent us to, and truly it does flow with milk and honey. Here is its fruit. But the people who live there are powerful. The cities are fortified and very large. We even saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites live in the Negev. The Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hill country. And the Canaanites live near the sea and along the Jordan. Now, verse 30. And then Caleb silenced the people before Moses and said, we should go up and take possession of the land, for we can certainly do it. But the men who had gone up with him said this, quote, we can't attack these people. They are stronger than what we are. And they spread among the Israelites a bad report about the land that they had explored and said, the land we explored devours those living in it. And all the people we saw there are of great size. We saw the Nephilim. The descendants of Anak come from the Nephilim. We seemed like grasshoppers in our own eyes, and we looked the same to them. So you have these reports coming back, the reports of the majority, and then you also have the minority report, which was given by Joshua and Caleb. It concurred with the majority in what they said, but it did not agree with the conclusions drawn and recommended by the majority report. Caleb, Joshua has seen the obstacles which had been reported, yet they urged Israel to go up and possess the land. Now my question for you right now is, why did the reports differ? They all saw the same, right? Same thing. Why did the reports differ? They saw the same land, the same cities, the same obstacles. Both saw the same picture. But the majority failed to see the most important element. What do you think that most important element was? They failed to see the most important element. If I were to ask you what it is, what would you say? Not a trick question. It's a very easy answer. They forgot and they didn't see God. They didn't see God. And the picture is always brighter if we include God. What He can and will do is phenomenal. That's why we walk by faith and not by sight. Because God sees the same obstacles we do, but He's bigger than any obstacle that we will ever face. Philippians 4, verse 13. Keep your place in Numbers, but Philippians chapter 4, and specifically verse 13. Philippians 4, verse 13 says this: I can do everything through Him who gives me strength. I can do everything through God who gives me strength. After all, had they forgotten what God did in bringing them out of Egypt? The plagues that were put upon the Egyptians? How about the time when they were camped beside this thing called the Red Sea? Surrounded, mountains on one side, the Egyptian army behind them, and the Red Sea in front of them. They had no place to go. And God tells Moses what to do. He hands, takes his staff, holds it out over the water, and it miraculously divides. And it says they walk through dry shod. When they get to the other side, the Egyptians are pursuing them, and what happens? The water comes pouring in. And it says they don't see them again. You see, they forgot the phenomenal magnitude of God and what God is capable of doing. They didn't see God in the picture. You can check Hebrews chapter 13, verses 5 and 6. Well, let me just read it. Hebrews 13, verses 5 and 6. Keep your lives free from the love of money, and be content with what you have, because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake you. So we have this confidence. The Lord is my helper. I will not be afraid. What can men do to me? What can man do to me when you have God on your side? And that's what the people didn't see. At least the majority report didn't see that. So let's take a look at why this generation was lost and what we can learn today. After all these things were written for our benefit, remember? They were written for our benefit, upon whom the ends of the age come. They were inspired to be written that we could learn from these experiences. So why was this generation lost? And what can we learn? Number one. They drew back. When they refused to go up to possess the land, God withdrew His promise and declared that they would not enter in until all those who had murmured had died in the wilderness. So when they drew back, they sentenced themselves to 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. And God said all of them would die in the wilderness. A year for a day. That's Numbers chapter 14, verses 26 through 25. I'm not going to read that. They drew back. What does God tell us in Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 35? Lessons for us today. Hebrews 10, beginning in verse 35. So do not throw away your confidence, Israel. By the way, Israel's not in that verse. But for the sake of the sermon, do not throw away your confidence, Israel. It will be richly rewarded. You need to persevere so that when you have done the will of God, you will receive what he has promised. For in just a very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. But my righteous one will live by faith. We know that Jesus Christ, who was the righteous one, did. But also, who else is the righteous one? We might say the righteous ones. And God says, become you holy before I am holy. He says that you are a special generation. You are the Israel of God. Drawing the analogy with ancient Israel. But my righteous one will live by faith. But if he shrinks back, I will not be pleased with him. They drew back. That's one of the primary reasons that God did not allow them to go into the promised land. He did allow their children, 20 years of age and under. So the same can happen to us if we allow ourselves to draw back. Number two, they rejected the minority report without consideration or investigation. Let me just quote Exodus 32 and verse 2, where it says, do not follow the crowd in doing wrong. We have a tendency in this nation, and really I think most people, to feel that the majority is always right. Right? And often that is the case, but not always. They were willing to follow the majority account and not the minority. You see, we have to evaluate not the people, the numbers, but what is it they are saying? What is the foundation upon which they build, right? And the foundation should always be God's word. In Numbers chapter 14, in verse 10, after Joshua and Caleb said what they did and encouraged them to go in and possess the land because it was exceedingly good, and if the God be pleased with us, he will lead us into the land flowing with milk and honey and will give it to us. So don't rebel against God. And then in verse 10, it says, but the whole assembly talked about stoning them. They got so upset and angry that they talked about killing Joshua and Caleb for the report that he gave and because they were encouraging the people to move forward and not draw back. So the people, when they heard the majority report, were satisfied with it. You know, it's dangerous to blindly follow the crowd. Because often the minority report is right. Can you think of any other biblical examples where the minority report is right? Who here knows about the person called Noah? Noah, he was definitely in the minority. But he was correct. God was guiding and directing him. How about Elijah, who stood alone against 450 false prophets of Baal? By himself. And another one that we don't sometimes think about, how about Barabbas? You were in an election cycle. He got more votes than Jesus. And Christ was put to death. Now we all know and realize that Christ had to be put to death because of the purpose, one of the purposes for his coming. Number three, they magnified their difficulties. Now this is something we might be able to relate to a little bit more. Okay? Do we have a tendency to magnify our difficulties? Or that's our primary focus, our difficulties? They magnified their difficulties. They saw only trials and hardships while closing their eyes to blessings and opportunity. You know, Numbers 14:31, God said he would bring them into the land. He talked about all the many opportunities that would be there as they took possession of the land, the things that they would be inheriting. You know, when the children of Israel went into the land, the children of the children of Israel went into the land, you had people like Jabez. Jabez's prayer was, Father, bless me indeed and enlarge my territory. May your hand be with me. Keep me from evil that I don't cause any pain or have pain. He ended up in the promised land, and he asked God to enlarge his territory. And you'll read at the end of that prayer, God did exactly what he requested because his spirit and attitude was right. The people who didn't go into the land, the lost generation, missed out on all those blessings that could have been theirs to have. So they only saw the hardships. They saw giants, walled cities, but forgot God in his providence. How about the Apostle Paul? Hold your place in Numbers. And look at 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verses 7 through 9. Now, Paul could have focused on his problems and magnified them. He had an issue that probably many of us have faced when it came to health. Verse 7, it says, talking about, again, his issue in life. He sought God three times for it to be removed. But verse 7, breaking into the thought, he says, it was left to keep me from becoming conceited because of these surprising great revelations that were given to me. I ended up with this thorn in the flesh, a messenger of Satan to torment me. Three times I pleaded with the Lord to take it away from me, but he said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, did Paul continue to wallow in his misery? Did he continue to say, woe is me, and focus on the problems that were extant? No, he says this, therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses so that Christ's power may rest on me. You know, I've witnessed in my 50 years in the ministry individuals who have gone through very similar, if not same, problems. I really have. Some very serious issues. One in way back in Uniontown, Pennsylvania, when I was a ministerial trainee, where a young man, probably 25, 30, was walking down the road. A car lost control and hit him on the sidewalk, and he became a paraplegic. He suffered emotionally, mentally, for a while, for sure. But over time, he came to the attitude and the spirit that this is where I am. And if God can use me in this condition to encourage and help others, so be it. And his life began to just take off, and he always had a smile on his face. I've seen others have similar issues, and they were devastated, and basically their life was lost, even though they were alive. They were crushed emotionally, mentally. What was the difference? What was the difference? Often it's because of what we looked here, we magnify our difficulties. Now, brethren, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying we don't have difficulties. I mean, Mr. Hooser went through some situations that are very painful and very hard and very, well, it's hard to hear even, you know, some of the things that our brethren are going through. But our eyes have to get beyond our present moment into the fact and reality of who our Father and Jesus Christ are, who they are, and what they have planned, and ask them to help us through these issues. There's a statement where God says that he will give us a way of escape through any trial that we face. It's not wrong to ask God to help you see the escape. Okay? It's not wrong. He said it, and I've done that enough. I've asked right now for God to help me see what I can do for my wife. When I left this morning, Sonia was probably in the most pain I've seen her in since our marriage. Shingles, horrendous. And it came on her last night. So I would love to see that window open and an escape path be shown. Healing definitely can do that. So the Apostle Paul forgot his thorn in the flesh because the assurance that comes from God. Again, with every difficulty, God makes provisions for his own. Romans 8:31, you know, if God is for us, who can be against us? Hebrews is very clear in Hebrews 13 and verse 6. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13, which I quoted, you know, he makes a way of escape. Number four, Number four, they did not respect themselves and especially didn't respect God. You know, I've seen individuals in our congregations around the United States in particular, individuals who have no self-respect. They have no self-esteem. Self-esteem is not a bad word, brethren. You know, God makes us who we are. And we should respect who we are because of what God has done on our behalf. Now, we're not talking about egotism, vanity, and how great I am, all right? There's a difference. That's not really self-respect. Self-respect is when you respect who you are, what you've done, and what you've accomplished, especially with God helping you. With God helping you. You know, there's a statement that I tried to teach to my granddaughter Mackenzie when she was small, a very special young lady at ABC this year. Hard to believe she's finished her freshman year of college last year and is at ABC right now. But she had this issue in the back seat of our vehicle. She had broken her swimming goggles. Her mother let her bring them, even though she did not want her to. And when they broken, Mackenzie was just absolutely brokenhearted, and number one, thought she was going to get in trouble because she was encouraged not to take them. And so we're sitting there, and I mean, she is just going on and on and on. And of course, Colin's sitting off to the side. And finally, I turned around and said, Kenzie, what's wrong, sweetheart? And I knew what was wrong. She began to explain it to me. I said, well, look, you're hollering and screaming, and you're whining. It's not going to resolve the problem. It's going to make you feel better for a while. I said, but you do have an issue, no question. If you can learn this at a young age, identify the problem, which was easy to identify. Goggles broken, right? I said, identify the problem, which you must do, but then you've got to put your energy into finding a solution. Finding a solution. So identify the problem and then focus on the solution. If you use a clock, we've got a clock in the back, and just say you've got an hour. Identify the problem. Take the first 10 minutes, okay? From the 12 to the 2, identify the problem, but from 2 to the following 12, focus on the solution. Why is that? Because when you focus on the solution, you're putting your energy, right, in a powerful way toward the positive. I mentioned this to a few people at the home office. I pastored Cincinnati North and Dayton, and I was invited to a meeting when I was there teaching Harmony of the Gospel, and I didn't say a whole lot because I was just invited to listen. And when they finished, I mentioned to two particular men, I said, you know what? I said, man, I see the problem. You guys identified the problem greatly. I said, but we wrapped things up and nobody ever talked about finding a solution or focusing on the solution. They didn't even put a committee together to focus on the solution. Basically, they were going to meet again. And so I mentioned that concept to one of them. He said, you know, that's a very good one. Identify the problem, but focus on the solution. Now, Mackenzie quieted down and we began to discuss solutions. Papa could fix the goggles, right? Or Papa could do this. Well, they were broken so badly that Papa wasn't going to be able to do anything. But sitting next to my granddaughter was Colin, who I didn't realize was involved. And he said, Papa, I've got a solution. I said, really, Colin? What is that? He says, you can buy her a new pair. And that ended up being the solution that we followed. You know, Papa bought her a new pair of goggles. So when you don't respect yourself, you have a hard time focusing on solutions. You really do. All you're going to do is see the problems around you and have the attitude, well, I deserve it. I deserve all these difficulties. You know, it's my fault that my husband whips me. It's my fault, you know, that whatever. Now, I know none of you husbands whip your wives, right? But that gets the point across. It's my fault that my dad and mom divorced. No. But people feel that way, and they grow up with no godly self-esteem. And that's unfortunate. They didn't respect themselves. What did they say? We were like grasshoppers in their sight, but more importantly, we were like grasshoppers in our own sight. Right? Remember reading that? Numbers 13, 32, and 33. They should have remembered. You know, I gave a sermon of faith quite a while ago. One destroyer of faith is not remembering, right? Not remembering. They just what God does for us. Not remembering. They should have remembered that they had over 600,000 warriors who had never been defeated. They had never been defeated. They didn't think about that. Never been defeated. The same God who delivered them from Egypt was still with them. Self-denunciation and humility does not mean selling God short. It means realizing that God's with you and will strengthen you and give you the ability to accomplish the job. They did not respect themselves. 1 John 3, verses 1, 2, and 3 tells us that we must never belittle our worth. Never belittle our worth. Because God says, we don't know what we are going to be exactly, but we know this, we shall be like Him. Don't belittle your worth. Next one, number 5, I believe. They were looking back and not ahead. They were looking back and not ahead. Numbers 14, 1 through 4 discusses that. It was a favorite refrain of theirs, right? Oh, had we stayed in Egypt. Oh, if we could go back to Egypt. Oh, think about the garlic and the leeks, right? Oh, if we could go back. Anytime there was an issue, they wanted to go back. They looked back and not ahead. They turned their attention back to Egypt. They remembered the experiences of yesterday, but did not look with anticipation to what lay ahead. We must always look to the future. Notice Luke chapter 6. I'm sorry, Luke chapter 9. Luke chapter 9. Breaking into the thought, I don't need to go through the story. The summarization statement is adequate enough for the sermon. Luke 9 and verse 62. But Jesus said to him, the one who was making excuses, no one, having put his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God. No one who takes the reins and looks back. Oh, it was so much better when I did this and didn't know the truth. No, can't do that. That will destroy you. No one, having put his hand to the plow and looking back, is fit for the kingdom of God. Colossians 3. Colossians 3. And let's start reading in verse 1. Colossians chapter 3. In verse 1, it says, if then you are raised with Christ, seek those things which are above, where Christ is sitting at the right hand of God, and set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth, because you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. And when Christ, who is our life, appears, then you also will appear with Him in glory. That is where our vision has to be. We must always be pushing forward with the truth. We must always look to the future. And lastly, the last point is they were unwilling to pay the price. They were unwilling to pay the price. The cost was reckoned when they went into the promised land, and it was considered to be too much. It was considered to be too much. You know, they might have become too soft from accepting free manna in all the deliverance. I don't know. But the cost was too much. And yet God says, we must be willing to meet the demands of God. Be willing to meet the demands of God. Notice Luke chapter 9. In verse 23, Luke 9, 23. Then he said to them all, if anyone would come after me, He must deny himself, take up his cross daily, and follow me. God says we have to count the cost and then move forward with our life. Count the cost and take up your cross daily and follow him. We don't know exactly what we're going to face, but whatever it is, if we've counted the cost, we have said nothing shall separate us, right, from the love of God, and we will move forward. So we have to be willing to meet the demands of God. Count the cost, but be willing to pay the price. Notice Luke 14. Luke chapter 14. Similar statement, just a few chapters later, beginning in verse 27. Luke 14, 27. If anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me, anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple. You cannot enter into the promised land. He who was not willing to bear his cross, count the cost, and then enter into the promised land would not get there. Speaking of ancient Israel. He says, suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will you not sit down first, estimate the cost, see if you have enough money to complete it? For if he lays the foundation and is not able to finish, everyone who sees it will ridicule him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. And it gives the analogy of going to war against a king, counting the cost, and then taking and doing that which is required of us. Romans 8. Chapter 18, Romans chapter 8, Paul gives some very encouraging words here, and he uses some pretty serious examples to get his point across, right? Counting the cost. Let's start in verse 17. It says, and if children, then heirs of God, joint heirs with Christ, if indeed we suffer with him, that we may also be glorified together. The way we suffer with Christ is for our religion, our belief, not for being a thief, etc. But, you know, if we're persecuted for what we believe, threatened to lose a job over the Sabbath, feast, you know. He says, if you take that, hold fast, blessed are you, because I can make a way of escape. And I've got numerous stories I can tell you about people who were threatened. In one instance, a guy who was threatened to lose his job and went to the feast anyway, came back. That same foreman was there who gave him nothing but pain for about a month after he got back. Ironically enough, the second month, his foreman was fired. And guess who got the foreman's job? The man who was threatened with loss of job. God knows our heart. He knows our faith. He knows when we stand true. If our ways please the Lord, he says he blesses us. We should never, ever forget that. We count the price. Continuing then in verse 18, it says, for I consider that the suffering of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory which shall be revealed in us. Because the earnest expectation of the creation eagerly waits for the revealing of the sons of God. As Paul says, there's nothing that we can really face in this life that should deter us from following him, obeying him, looking forward to his great, great promises. So we must always be willing to pay the price for our Christianity. And what I have found in my first Feast of Tabernacles was 1959, what I found in my life, the overwhelming majority have been blessings. Have there been trials? Sure. But they've been blessings. And I thank God for them. You know, it's pathetic and it's sad that an entire generation was lost. Now, the positive side from that story is we know that God is who he is and he came to save the lost, right? We know that they are not ultimately lost, that their chance of salvation is yet in the future, shown by the last great day, the eighth day of the feast, and they have a brilliant hope But boy, they lost out on a lot. They really did. They could have been spending 40 years in the promised land, enjoying the fruits of their labor, a land flowing with milk and honey, and they didn't. What a pathetic and sad situation. So we must apply the lessons of this lost generation to ourselves today, that we don't end up losing out on our promised land. Remember, Romans 15, verse 4, and 1 Corinthians chapter 10, and verse 11, tell us that all of these things are written for our benefit. We should learn. That's why studying the Bible is beneficial. You know, I have a saying. Matter of fact, I was reading the other day. It said that the difference between a smart man and a wise man is simply how they learn. Simply how they learn. A smart person learns from his own mistakes. And it's good to learn from your own mistakes. But a wise person learns from the mistakes of others. You learn from the mistakes of others, you save yourself potential pain and heartache. You know, you see, he does this and the outcome is horrible. I'm not going to do that, right? You see him do that something else and the outcome is phenomenal, wonderful. You say, I might want to follow that example. Matter of fact, I used to try to emphasize to my sons, OPE, other people's experience, is the best teacher of all. I mentioned that at ABC. Does anyone here know what OPE stands for? Actually, it was at summer camp. I take that back. Does anyone here know what OPE stands for? And he says, yeah, old people's experience. No. It's true, but it's other people's experience. Other people's experience. So we must not be unmindful of the warnings given to us by God, but also not unmindful of his blessings and what he wants us to inherit. So, brethren, let's learn from ancient Israel, not repeat their mistakes, but be followers of Joshua and Caleb. Let's enter our promised land.